This is Ethan, and I'm here with Dave, and together we are Dave and Ethan's 2,000 Inch Weird Al Podcast, episode 225 Inch.
On this episode, we interview Janet Greek, the director behind Weird Al's first ever music video, Ricky.
It's Dave and Ethan's 2,000 Inch Weird Al Podcast.
It's a podcast about Weird Al.
It's Dave and Ethan's 2,000 Inch Weird Al Podcast.
Seriously, the whole podcast is about Weird Al.
Dave and Ethan's 2,000 Inch Weird Al Podcast.
You don't have to listen, but we're glad you are.
Dave and Ethan's 2,000 Inch Weird Al Podcast.
Hey, David, I'm home.
I see you are very excited for this episode's guest.
How did you guess that, Dave? I cannot wait for us to go all the way back in time to Weird Al's very first ever music video.
Well, we cannot wait for our listeners to hear all about it later this episode. But first, we want to thank each and every one of our listeners for the great feedback that you all sent us on last week's episode with Robert Smigel.
We are so glad to hear that everyone loved it so much. And speaking of Robert and Triumph, why don't you do them a solid and go and check out the full special available right now on YouTube.
A solid? Really?
Hey, it's a Triumph the Insult comic dog special. It's on brand, Dave.
Fair enough. On that note, let's get to all the latest poop and what's happening in Weird Al related news.
The full Mo Willems and the Storytime All-Stars Live at San Francisco Sketchfest special has been made available to watch on YouTube.
Head on over to the Mo Willems Workshop YouTube channel to see the full performance featuring Weird Al and a bunch of other great comedians.
Plus, you'll get to hear Weird Al perform The Ice Cream Truck is Broken, Mo Willems' parody of Vesti La Juba.
And be sure to keep an eye out for the back of our very own Ethan Ullman's head in the audience. He's down on the bottom left.
Weird Al is the entertainment honoree for the Valley of the Stars Awards Gala, presented by Bechtel, happening Thursday, April 25th at Hilton Los Angeles, Universal City.
We saw a post online about Weird Al filming a video in relation to the event, so we aren't quite sure if he will be there in person to accept the honor or not.
If you want to chance it for a glimpse of Weird Al, and why wouldn't you, tickets only cost $300 and are available for purchase at thevalley.net/gala2024.
From all of us here at Dave and Ethan's 2000 Inch Weird Al Podcast, a huge congratulations to Weird Al for this prestigious honor.
New York Festival's Radio Awards has announced their short list of nominees for 2024.
Among the nominees is Raina Doris for her interview with none other than Weird Al Yankovic on WXPN Philadelphia's World Cafe.
From all of us here at Dave and Ethan's 2,000 Inch Weird Al Podcast, a huge congratulations to Raina Doris and the WXPN team. Good luck!
According to the Greater Austin Comic Con's Instagram account, Weird Al will be headed there later this summer.
Their event takes place July 20th and 21st at the HEB Center at Cedar Park in Cedar Park, Texas.
While no further information is available at this time, we expect that this will be an opportunity for photos and autographs and not a performance or panel with Weird Al.
For tickets and more information as it's announced, head on over to greateraustincc.com.
Our friend Steve Allen let us know that there is a video game called Corn Kids 64 with a unique Weird Al connection.
According to his son, there's some sort of palindrome town in the game where everything is based on the lyrics to Weird Al's song Bob.
And just like Bob, Corn Kids 64 does not have a music video.
Hey! This episode is brought to you in part by vegan burrito restaurant Burrito Burrito, home of the 2-pound double wrapped in a quesadilla Burrito Burrito and Wizard Burger in Albany, New York. Come on down to Burrito Burrito and Burrito Burrito your Burrito Burrito and Wizard Burger for mouthwatering loaded, dare I say beefy, vegan burgers. From Albany to Uranus, Burrito Burrito and Wizard Burger feed the hungry with out of this world, plant-based, real food, always vegan style. Visit BurritoSquare.com and WizardBurger.com to order ahead.
Okay, let's check out what's happening in Dave and Ethan's 2000 Inch Weird Al Podcast related news. Our friend William King is holding a March Weirdness tournament in our Facebook group, and this year's theme is based off of Weird Al singles with A-sides versus B-sides.
Voting is open right now, so head on over to group.2000inch.com to join in the fun and help ensure your favorites move on to the next round. All right, Dave, why don't you take us back to 1983 for this episode's interview.
Ethan and I are absolutely thrilled to welcome to the podcast the director behind Weird Al's first ever music video, Ricky, the great and talented Janet Greek. How are you doing, Janet? Welcome to the podcast.
Hi, I'm doing just fine, and I'm very excited to be here talking with you about Al and Ricky. It's great for me. Thank you.
It is so exciting to have you on. And to start off, obviously, Ricky came right at the beginning of your career. And looking at your Wikipedia page, it says your years active are 1984 to present. But Ricky was released in 1983. So were you not active at that time? I hope you can clear this up because everyone's clamoring to know.
Yes, I actually made my very first movie, which was a short subject movie. Called Good Neighbors. And I made that in 1980. And that movie won the Silver Venus Award, I guess, at the Houston Film Festival that following April.
Wow.
And I thought my career was going to be launched then. And I was, you know, a long time ago, women weren't getting very many jobs in the film business. So I started writing screenplays. And then I had an opportunity to direct an independent movie about rape. And it was based on a true story. And I did make that movie. And I made that movie in 1982, edited it. And then that was a nasty story about what sometimes happens to independent filmmakers when their projects are taken away from them.
Oh, man.
And so that movie, which was called Take Back the Night, was taken away from me because the group that financed it didn't really want the kind of movie. I had made a movie that was a pretty much a political statement about rape, and they wanted a soft porn movie.
Oh, they didn't mention that.
It was a big difference. Yeah, they didn't tell me that, but ahead of time, they just assumed that that's what would happen because I was doing a rape movie. Wouldn't it be soft porn right down the line?
Oh,
yeah.
Jeez.
That was pretty shocking. So, I screened the movie a couple of places. I was able to get a screening at a theater on the Fox lot and invited a lot of industry people. And I had a lot of really, really positive feedback about it. But the men who put up the money, the independent producers, that's not the movie they wanted. So they literally took it away from me and recut it and they released it as a movie called The Violated. Mm. And it got I took my name off the movie. I made them list me as A.K. Allen. And although my lawyer laughed and their lawyer laughed about that choice, they never understood that it was a blatant A.K.A.
Right.
I wasn't really who was making the movie. So years later, somebody actually figured out that it was me. But I did that. And then right after I did Ricky in 83, I got a chance to direct an episode of St. Elsewhere. And that put me in the Directors Guild. And that's why it says 83 is the beginning of my career.
Got it.
Oh, gotcha. Yeah. Interesting. So you touched on a little bit, Janet. I was interested in asking you about it. What was it like being a female director in the early 1980s? I imagine there wasn't too many of them.
No, I was one of the first, I think, five females in the DGA. There were women. Yeah, women were directing a lot during World War II. Ida Lupino and, you know, many other women in the 40s and stuff were directing. And then once World War II ended, it was a closed shop, men only. And so I came from the theater. And so I was directing in theater very early on and for a long time. And when I got down to Los Angeles, I just assumed I would be directing in 6 months at least. I'd get my, you know, I'd get going and get my balance, and then there I would go. And that didn't happen at all. So I struggled for a long time to try to work and try to, and that's why I made the first independent movie, The Short Subject. I made that and financed it. I worked in dramatic series development and a couple of other jobs at NBC when I first got down there. And I saved money to make that movie. And that, even though I didn't get a job directly from that, that really gave me a start. I was able to, you know, I got an agent. I was able to send it out so that people knew I could really direct. And so, you know, slowly, St. Elsewhere gave me a chance. Bruce Paltrow and Mark Tinker, they were amazing. Mm. And they gave me a chance doing that show. And I was the first woman to direct that show. And it was not easy. It was never easy, especially in those early years. But I did have, of course, then I had great experiences with a lot of the other teams that I worked with over the years after that.
So I would love to hear how you became connected with Weird Al and Jay Levy for the Ricky music video.
Well, I am not exactly sure, but I think my recollection is that my friend Hamilton Cloud, who was a disc jockey, he also worked with me at NBC for a while, but he was a disc jockey and he was a big music guy. And I think he and Jay knew each other. And I think that that's how I met them. And I have tried to get a hold of Hamilton actually for a bit. He's very busy. He does something else now. And he'll know, but I can't remember exactly. What I do remember though is going in to meet them for the first time and how nervous I was. I was so nervous. And they were so nice. I mean, they were both just so great. And so it was exciting immediately as soon as I met them. And they, right away, they, you know, we met for about 10 minutes, I think. And then they, we really want you to do this. And I said, I really want to do it too.
Wow.
That's how it started.
Now, we talk to a lot of people who work with Weird Al, and, you know, a lot of people go into a meeting with Weird Al with a very, you know, strong understanding of his work and Eat It and all this stuff. But you came in right at the beginning. Were you even aware of Weird Al at that point?
No, not until I was told about him and went to this meeting. I had heard, Hey, Ricky, I don't know how I heard it, whether I think I had a tape of it. And anyway, I heard it and I was just, and I knew about the Tony Basil hit and I just thought it was great. I thought it was amazing. And you're right. I mean, I couldn't look back at the other videos to see what somebody had done.
Like, right. You know,
I couldn't get an album and listen to all the songs and go, wow, this guy's amazing. But, you know, it only took one song for me to realize that how incredible he was.
And so in that first meeting, was there already an idea for what the video would look like? Or was that something that was really collaborative between you guys?
Well, they had an idea for what they wanted. That's for sure.
Okay.
And we talked about it and talked about it and talked about it and tweaked it. And then I made a storyboard for it. And believe me, that was hilarious because I can't draw at all. But but I did. And, you know, then we had a very, very clear plan, the three of us, and it was very collaborative. I mean, I would say actually that it is the most collaborative experience I've had in filmmaking.
Wow.
Oh, wow. Nice. Wow.
Yeah. I was really spoiled. That's how I thought it would always be. And I wasn't correct about that, but you know, I had a lot of great experiences, of course, but this one was just really seamless and it was so much fun. Al made it really fun. He was so professional and so relaxed, and Jay made it fun and he made everything as easy for me as he could. And we shot it in a little house someplace in the valley. I have no idea where that could have been, but it was a tiny house and it was summer and it was hot. And Al had to be in that Ricky wig. Oh my God. The biggest weight we had when we got there in the morning, was to wait for him for whoever did hair to get all that hair into the wig. It was crazy. But what we did was we shot the little sequence where he's actually playing with the band, and you see the whole band. That was right. Shot first.
Right.
First. And then, so they lit it and we got ready and everybody, you know, it was a small crew and everybody was great. And then we settled and we shot that. And then we had a big wait while he, you know, got into different makeup and got all of his hair under that thing. And poor guy, it was so hot. And anyway, that's how we got going.
So there's a lot of things I'm curious about with this video, because, you know, obviously looking back, the first time I saw the video, it was on VHS or DVD, but this was literally the first Weird Al video. This was when MTV was still just a couple years old. And I'm just really curious about, you know, Al's introduction to this format of video. He is wearing a wig. He's got the mustache shaved. He doesn't have the glasses, and it's in black and white. It seems like a lot of weird choices. And I'm curious if that was discussed at the time.
Yes, we discussed everything. And we did it in black and white because originally that show was shot in black and white.
Right.
So Lucille Ball was in black and white. And so we shot it like that. That's the reason we didn't want to leave it in black and white for the whole thing, but that's the reason we had the idea I had the idea for him to fling his arm out and then the whole thing would turn into color. And that was quite fun.
That was really fun.
I wanted it to be as if he were almost like pulling a curtain aside, but I don't think the technology was there then to do that actually. I'm not quite sure. The way that it turned out was great. It was just wonderful. But that was the concept for sure. It was the concept. We wanted to make it like so that it really looked like Lucy and Ricky and an episode of the show. And I cannot remember the name of the woman who played Lucy. Do you have that name?
Yeah, Tress McNeil.
That's right. She was a very, very prominent member of the Groundlings. And The Groundlings is a comedy workshop, and it's a workshop and training center for a lot of comedic actors in Hollywood, and it's been around forever, and it's still there. So I don't remember how we got her.
Yeah, well, Tress did the original voice on the recording itself, so she probably came in through Al. He probably...
Oh, that must be it then.
Maybe he had her in mind when he, you know, was writing the song to also do a video, or perhaps he just figured she would be a good fit anyway.
Oh, good. So thanks for filling that in for me, because I can't remember that. Boy, she was just great. She was great.
Oh, she was incredible. Absolutely. She looks like Lucy and she acts like Lucy. She was perfect for the role.
she watched a lot of the shows to make sure she could really be as good as possible. And she really did it. She just hit it. It was wonderful. And I will tell you, Al was extraordinary. He is a natural actor. And maybe that's not so surprising because he's also a musician and a performer. But you know, everybody can't do that. And he was it was so easy to work with him. And he was very meticulous, and I am too. And so I don't remember ever having one disagreement about let's shoot it again, let's try this again, let's do this. And it was just, you know, it was just fun all the way along. It took a long time. And I think the shoot was like 16 hours long.
Oh,
and
wow.
We didn't expect that. I just remember it was much, much later than we thought. I remember being outside under a tent in the dark looking at the video playback and thinking, how much longer are we going to be here? And the people, we shot the end of the video at the end of the night. So all the people that we had called to come. And Hamilton Cloud is in that video. He is playing bongos in the very front, sitting on the floor. Uh-huh. So that's why I think I'm pretty sure there's an Al, there's a connection there, I think. But I'll ask Hamilton anyway about that. But those people all had to wait. But, you know, that's That's life in the movies.
Right. Now, I'm back to the black and white. Was it shot in black and white, or was it shot in color and converted?
I do not remember, but my guess is it was shot in color and converted.
Yeah.
You know, Jay would remember that, I would bet. That's something I didn't really, I don't really remember that.
I would love to see an all color version of it just to see all the colors. And
Yeah. I don't know if they have that, but it would be interesting.
That would be cool.
That would be really interesting. But I'm sorry. That's something I just don't remember. I mean, it was a while ago.
Oh, of course. I guess kind of back to a comment I made earlier, Al is starring in this and he really is made up to look like Ricky. He does not look like Al because all of his iconic features are covered up or changed. And I'm curious if there was ever a conversation of, do we have Ricky look more like Al? Do we give him a mustache and glasses? Or, you know, I'm curious to hear about what that conversation was like.
No, we wanted him to be Ricky. We wanted it to be Ricky Lucy as close as possible as we could get it to visually.
So there wasn't that consideration that, you know, we're putting Al out for the first time, but people, you know, don't know what he looks like necessarily.
No, we didn't.
Oh, interesting.
There was no conversation. We loved the idea that people would start to see this and hopefully wouldn't know it was him until they open the door and they see the band playing.
Oh, that's true. That's true. Yeah. Cause I guess the context that I see the video is I know it's Al, but yeah, I mean, you're just watching MTV and this thing comes on. You're like, oh, I guess it's an episode of I Love Lucy.
You don't know what it is exactly until that's why that door opens and you see the band playing.
That's interesting. Yeah, I hadn't thought about that. And I saw it much earlier than Ethan saw it. I saw it, but I going in knowing it was Weird Al also, but not knowing that it was Weird Al portraying Ricky. And it took me several views, and it took my cousin to actually explain to me that, no, that really is Weird Al there.
That really
that's
is
not
Weird
a different
Al.
Actor. So I think we had to pause it on VHS and you know, pull up a picture of Weird Al and look at the eyes and the facial features. So I'll tell you, the goal of you guys pulling that off to make Weird Al look like Ricky Ricardo, it had me fooled as a young child, definitely, for quite a while.
I'm happy to hear that. Also, there's a moment in that video where that door opens again and Ricky and Lucy run through the door backwards.
Yes. Right?
And we did that to screw with the audience even more. Double in the wig. And then we rushed them through that door from the back. So it looks like the person playing Ricky in the whole show is running right past the band.
I think that's what fooled me the most is that, as I said, how could Weird Al be in this thing twice?
That was very calculated. I can't remember who came up with that idea. I think it might have been Jay, actually.
Oh, yeah.
But I'm not sure which one of us did that. But I thought it was a great touch, for sure.
Do you recall who put on the Ricky outfit and hair to pull that off?
Oh, heavens no. I have no idea. I think, you know, actually, the only thing that I remember, it's possible that it was a member of the crew.
Okay.
That we just had one member of the crew ready to do that. So... that's all I remember about it, though. So I really don't quote me on that one.
And I mean, you mentioned that like your friend Hamilton was there. And, you know, I know that from past conversations we've had with people who were on the set, you know, band members and things like that, that, you know, they were on the set and, you know, maybe some of Weird Al's friends were on the set. Were there any other people that you had brought in or that you knew that were from other outside of this video shoot that were on the set?
No, I didn't have any. I didn't invite anybody to come. It didn't even occur to me. I didn't even tell anybody where I was going to shoot it because I mostly didn't want people. I just wanted to work and I didn't want to have any distractions on the set myself. And that has continued for my whole career. I don't like to have people come and visit me on sets ever.
Was there any consideration to put yourself as a cameo in that end scene?
No.
That's not a thing you do?
That's not a thing I do.
See, I would. I'm such a ham. I would be tempted to put myself in anything I directed.
Well, you know, in some ways it's tempting. I mean, when I was shooting Babylon 5, I did 4 seasons of that show, and there were a couple of times when cast members and stuff were going, "Oh, come on, be in this show. Just say these 3 lines. Be this on the show." And I think that one or two of the other directors did that occasionally. I could have done it. I mean, I could have easily done it if I'd wanted to, but I always just was like, no, I don't think so.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah, it's safe behind the camera.
Yeah. Very fair. Now, you mentioned the crew, and I guess when I picture these early music videos, I picture like literally $0 in the budget to do this. And I know they were low, but what sort of crew did you have? What were you able to bring in, and what sort of other hats did you end up having to wear?
I did a little bit of, you know, moving furniture around and that kind of thing, but I didn't really have to do much. We had guys doing lighting. We had a DP. We had a director of photography. We had, you know, a sound guy. We had everything.
Oh, wow.
We had everything. I mean, Jay did a good job, and it was not like we had a huge crew, but, you know, we had, I don't remember how many people doing lighting and all that, but there were quite a few people there. And although the budget was certainly low, I mean, they fed us. They were, you know, we had some place to go to the bathroom. Some of those things that you don't always find.
Right.
So, you know, that, I mean, I don't recall that it was a sparse crew. It wasn't 20 people either, but it was probably,
it was an adequate size. That's cool.
Mm-hmm. And the person who did hair and makeup was great. And the set design was great. The sets were, they were finishing them. I think they couldn't get into that house till the morning of. And so, you know, there were a couple of people working, they were doing all that stuff, and it was great. In fact, as I recall, somebody was cutting the ironing board cut out of the iron out before we shot. I was with, you know, I was there when that was going on. But yeah, it was, I never felt like, oh my God, I can't believe there are 3 people doing all this. Yeah, no, that never happened. It was good. I've always been really lucky like that. When I did my very first short, Good Neighbors, I had a friend of mine who was already doing some producing. She produced it for me. I wrote it and directed it and financed it, but she produced it for me. And then we did it during the actors' strike, I believe it was in 1980 or 81, whenever they went out. Must have been 80. Mm-hmm. And she got the entire crew of Mork and Mindy to come and work for me for free.
Wow.
And they did. Oh. They did. They came in. I fed them really well. And it was a 3-day shoot. And they just said, this is how we'd like to give back to the industry. This is what we do to support other people who want to be in the industry. And that was pretty cool.
That is really cool. Yeah. That is really
cool. That is very cool.
Yeah, it was really cool. It really was great. And, you know, I just didn't, I didn't, I felt no lack during the shooting of Ricky. Everybody was good at what they did, and they did it well and as expediently as they could.
It's awesome to hear. So I want to go back a little bit to your initial conversation with Jay and Al about the music video. On many of Weird Al's later music videos, he does direct parodies of the actual original artist music video that he's covering. And at the time, Tony Basil had out the music video for Mickey, which was very cheerleader based. Was there ever any talk of doing a direct parody of her cheerleader video?
Never, never. It was always Lucy and Ricky.
Interesting.
Yeah, that was the idea from the very beginning.
So there was a cheerleader included in the video as a nod to the music video. Was there anything else that was considered or anything else in the video that maybe I haven't caught because I watched them side by side and I was like, okay, I assumed that there was going to be more because I don't think I'd ever seen the Mickey video until I was like, oh, I should probably watch this before I talk to Janet. And I guess I was surprised that there wasn't more, but it makes perfect sense. I mean, it's Al's first video and really it's a parody of I Love Lucy as opposed to a parody of right. Tony's video.
Yeah. The only parody were the words of the song.
Right.
And that was it. And yeah, and we didn't even, I mean, that cheerleader is right there in the front, but we don't make a big deal out of it. It's not like she ran to center stage at that last right. moment and was dancing in front of everybody else or anything like that either. We just put her in there. And
it's like an Easter egg, it seems like.
Yes, kind of. And I kind of always wondered how many people would get that.
Right.
If that's what there was a cheerleader in there. But, at least you guys did.
Yes.
There's a few stylized shots where it's sort of like almost like a GIF. It just like it plays and then it plays again. And I guess I always assumed that was a nod to the Mickey video. But then I'm watching the Mickey video and I didn't see that. So I'm really curious what the intention was behind those parts.
Well, I just did that in editing because it was funny.
It is funny.
It is. It's funny.
I just thought it was funny. And Jay thought it was funny and Al thought it was funny. So there you go.
So that's an original. That's awesome.
Yeah.
So Janet, I understand there was actually like an invited premiere of the Ricky music video. Do you have any memory of that and what it entailed?
I don't, actually. I don't. I remember that and I remember going, but I don't actually remember anything about it. I'm sorry to say.
I would have to guess that they played the music video at it, but that's just speculation.
Yeah. I don't know. Yeah, I know they played it on MTV a lot though when it came out.
Yeah, I mean, certainly I remember this video being played on MTV, and MTV was at its very early stages, and they were looking for lots of music videos. And my understanding is actually this is the first comedy music video that was ever played on MTV, or if not the first, it was most likely the first, near the first. When you were creating the video, when you were directing the video, coming up with the idea for the video, did you have like an outlet like MTV in mind?
No, I didn't. That was up to Jay and Al. I didn't know how they would use it. I think that I realized that probably it would be on MTV, but I just really didn't give that much thought. I just thought, well, you know, they're going to release it somehow. Mm-hmm. And, but you know, on the other hand, MTV was just about the only place they could do it unless they just enclosed it in an album or something, you know, somehow they did that. I don't know, but I don't really remember us ever talking about that. I do remember getting a call from Jay, I believe, saying that it was on MTV and I should turn on MTV and watch because it's actually on MTV. And I know that was a really big deal. We were pretty excited.
Oh,
it was the first black and white MTV video ever made.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, cool.
As well as the first comedy. And it was, and it made a top 10 list. I don't remember. They at the very beginning, they were doing like the top 10 videos of the year. And it made, I don't remember if it was the year, it must have been the year it was released to them. It was one of the top 10 videos of the year.
Oh, that's so awesome.
And that was pretty exciting. But you know, in those days, they didn't put on any credits and they didn't always even put on a title.
Oh.
As I recall. That you just, you know, the DJ for MTV would announce it and say what it was, but there weren't any credits on the listed. Oh,
interesting,
on the
yeah. My memories of MTV seem to have in the lower left hand corner, they would always have the artist, the name of the song, and the director, mm-hmm. as well as maybe the record label. But I didn't realize that wasn't included, at least initially, on the Ricky video.
No, I mean, my name was never on there.
Wow.
And I just think it was, if anything, it was just the, you know, Al and the title of the movie.
Right.
I mean,
right.
The movie, the song.
I'm really curious about what was the reaction from, I guess, the general public. Did you have any sense of that? I know you mentioned it, you know, it was a top 10 video and that kind of thing. But did you hear directly from people or fans or any kind of feedback?
I heard from Jay that they got a lot of feedback about how great it was. And I certainly had plenty of friends who watched MTV. And I, you know, I told a few people that I had directed it. And I got a lot of feedback from friends. Oh my gosh, you did. Oh my goodness. So, I was surprised and pretty exciting for me just to be able to say that too. I was really proud of doing that.
Very cool.
I've heard that sometimes when music videos are shot, it's, you know, maybe shot slower and then sped up to match the music. Was there anything like that in the taping?
No. Everything stayed pretty much.
Yeah.
That was true to, it was really true to the recording. Hmm.
I guess we absolutely have to mention, you know, Weird Al shaved his mustache to play the part of Ricky. And was it nerve-wracking to know that, you know, you have to film the Weird Al's Weird Al parts, and then as soon as he shaves it, you're kind of out of luck if you need to reshoot anything?
We just needed to all be sure that we were all happy.
Yeah.
And so we shot both the shot of the band that, you know, where the camera moves in through the door, and also the piece where the double runs through with Trish.
Right.
I mean, Tess. Yeah. With Tess. We shot those first, and then we all kind of went, okay, let's look at this. Are we sure? Do we have it? Do we have it? We do? Okay.
Was it a weird experience for you, you know, having worked with Al for a bit at this point, to see him in the wig with the shaved mustache with his voice?
Oh, it was so weird. It was really weird. It was hard for me. I remember as we started shooting those parts then that it was very strange for me to, I kept looking at him and going, oh God, who is this? Is this really Al? Yeah, no, it was weird. It was weird. I got used to it, but
right.
It's weird. Even when I watch it now, I look at it and go, wow, really?
It must be so surreal.
See?
Yeah.
I'm not the only one.
But then he'd, you know, I'd say cut, and then he'd go, hey, and can we do that again? Because da 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 da. And I go, yeah, okay. And then it was like that. Then it was Al, no matter what.
Right.
And then you go back into it. It was pretty interesting. It's the other time I've had experiences like that were when I was doing Babylon 5, because we had a lot of aliens.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
When I was shooting, and when I started that show the first season, I didn't see most of the leads that played aliens. I didn't ever see them out of makeup. And so some women came up to me one afternoon on the set and tapped me on the shoulder and said, hi. And I looked at her and I went, hi.
Do I know you?
Who are you? And she was one of the female leads of the show. I had never seen her without like 6 hours of makeup.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So I guess Al was my prep for that.
Right. Oh, that's amazing.
Cool. Well, there is one scene I do want to talk to you about, and that is one of my favorite scenes is when Lucy's doing the ironing and the iron falls through the ironing board, and then it shows them both Lucy and Ricky looking through the bottom of the ironing board as to what Lucy just did. Can you tell us about what it took to shoot that scene?
That scene was really funny. That was not an easy scene to shoot because we had to get all the steam and we had to get all the stuff right. And it took a while to get that all right. And then we had little Ricky in the background.
Right.
And
yeah,
you know, he was very good. He was very good. I don't remember whose child he was or anything about him, but he was really sweet. And anyway, he wasn't too much of a problem, but it was just a lot, you know, it was a lot, and it had to be quick. Everything had to be fast. And so it just took a little bit to get it all done. The rigging of all the stuff and the timing of when the exactly when
right,
that, right, when it falls,
iron fell through that thing. I mean, a couple of times the timing was wrong. She got there and grabbed it before it went down. Just the things you can imagine. And yeah. But you know, we did it. It was fine. And then we actually had them look through a cutout. They weren't looking through the real ironing board. I don't recall. I don't think that's what I recall, was that we had a cutout. Mm. We kind of held up a little bit so they could look through it, but it wasn't. They weren't peering down. Yeah. On the ground. I don't believe we had a cameraman on the floor there.
Yeah, I think that was revealed in the wonderful book by John Bermuda Schwartz, Black and White and Weird All Over. There are some great behind the scenes shots of the ironing board cutout, but also of the whole video shoot. I mean, he took some really spectacular pictures documenting that shoot.
Yeah, that's for sure. And thank goodness he did.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, his photographs are amazing.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah, I don't know if this will ring a bell with you at all, but when we were speaking with Bermuda previously, he did mention the name of Little Ricky. The actual actor's name is Sasha Guzzi. So I don't know if that rings any bells.
Oh, for my
you.
Gosh. I don't remember that at all.
Oh, okay.
Wow. Oh, funny. Yeah, he was, and I had a hard time getting him to be very enthusiastic, like drumming and stuff.
Yeah.
And I remember sitting there and trying to say, yeah, okay, do it like this, and just like this. And he'd laugh at me, and then he would go like, I'd say action, and then he would do it kind of in time and not very spontaneously. So anyway, but he was really adorable.
Yeah. So another mainstay of nostalgic MTV that you had a hand in is you directed some episodes of Max Headroom.
I did.
I would love to hear about your experience working on that.
Max Headroom was so much fun. I love science fiction, and I've been reading science fiction voraciously since I was like 20. And doing that show was really surreal in a lot of ways. not because of the sets necessarily, or you know, of the settings, but just because I couldn't believe that I got to be directing on this amazing show that was almost immediately a hit because of the movie from England. And it was something. And everybody on that show was so good and so talented. And it was the first time that I had a lot of experience with, a lot of experience with all the technology. You know, the green screens and the blue screens and all the stuff that would be like projected later, like the actual animation and stuff that appeared in all the TV or the video monitors or on the vid phone, you know, the vid phones and the video monitors and everything else. None of that was all put in later. Hmm. So the actors and I the script supervisor off screen would be reading the dialogue. And then, you know, like the animated Max Headroom person wasn't there at all. So after I saw the final cut of the first episode, I was amazed to see what they were, you know, how they were doing it. And of course, my first episode was episode 3, so at least I got to look at the first two episodes. I was able to look at them and see what it would look like. So I had a really clear idea of what it would look like. It wasn't that I had no clue, but it was very interesting. And the hardest part of that show was that the writing team was always late with everything. And I had one episode that I prepped for, and I did location hunting. I picked out locations. We did everything, casting, everything. And the producers pulled the script the day before I shot and gave me a brand new script and said, you're going to just shoot this thing on the sets that we chose for the other show, which had nothing to do with the one that I was now going to shoot. And I only had, I had about 20 hours to get ready for the whole thing.
Jeez.
That was pretty shocking.
Yeah.
That was, I would say.
Yeah. But it was but it was a big adventure, and I really liked it. And I was sorry that it was it was canceled because they kept going over budget so much that all the television executives were having a fit, and the producer was like, "This is too bad. You know, you want this show. This is a hit show. You're not going to cancel me." And the next day, we were canceled.
Wow.
Yeah. I happened to be sitting in his office when he was talking on the phone to the network executive. I don't know who that was, but he got off the phone, and I had been a network executive. And I said to him, I said, you might want to call him back and tell him that you've reconsidered and that you'll do better to make budget from now on. Mm-hmm. And he just said, you know, he was British. You know, he said, "I don't have to do that. They'll never cancel us."
Oh, man.
And I was 2 days from shooting. I was shooting every third episode, and I was 2 days from shooting my fourth episode. And we got a call that the plug was pulled. The show was done. That was it.
Wow.
Just like that. Yeah. Yeah. It was too bad because the show was really fabulous. And the producers were great. We had a good time. And I appreciated that they didn't want to skimp on how much it was costing, because it was a whole new deal to try to make those, you know, especially the locations, because we shot a lot in downtown Los Angeles in old buildings. I mean, we shot in the Bradbury building downtown, which is a historic building, and it's the architecture in it is amazing. And they've shot a lot of movies there. And when I got to shoot an episode, you know, a whole day there for an episode of one of those episodes, it was very exciting. And it was very expensive. It's a very expensive place to shoot. So, you know, the show reflected the budget, but, you know, it just wasn't in the cards to continue. But I had a blast.
Now, we had a great interview speaking with the director of the I Love Rocky Road music video, Dror Soref, and he mentioned to us that originally you were offered the role of the director and ended up suggesting him for the part.
Yes, I had a job on St. Elsewhere, and I couldn't, it was going to completely conflict. I wasn't available at all, and I was so sad. I had thought that I would certainly do more of Al's videos, but, you know, then my career just went in a different direction then. Mm-hmm. And Dror did it. And I was delighted to recommend him. And I know he did a good job.
Following Ricky, did you do any other music videos?
No. And I wanted to, but a lot of the people, I tried to get a couple of other jobs like that during a couple of periods where I wasn't directing something and I was writing something, I was reaching out. You know, at that time, they didn't really want to have a woman. And I had one guy say to me, "Nah, this is rock and roll. We need a guy to do this."
Jeez.
And I,
oh, wow.
And I was like, really? Come on. Yeah. Well, you know, there was a lot of that going on. And I'm grateful to all the producers that hired me in all those years.
I guess I'm curious, you know, first Black and White on MTV, first comedy on MTV. Were there many other female music video directors at that time on MTV?
You know, I really don't have any idea. I would doubt it.
Yeah.
But, you know, there was no way for me to know who was directing what because nobody's credits were there.
Right.
So I have never talked to another woman who's directed MTV who were, you know, in the years that I would have been doing that in the 80s and 90s. I mean, that may be very true now, but, you know, I don't know.
Mm. It's interesting. Yeah, I'd be curious to hear.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
So you shot this video with Weird Al back in 1983. Have you had any contact with Al in the years since then?
No, I haven't. Not at all.
Oh, wow.
And I know it. And I'm so sorry that I haven't. I don't know why. I mean, I should have tried to get in touch with him. I thought about him a lot. I followed his career, certainly. And I used to love to tell my friends, "Al's got a new song. You've got to hear this." I just all my friends listen to him because of me. So I like that. But I just, you know, no. The only time that I ever thought maybe about getting together or seeing him was when he was up here at this big venue in Jackson County, and he had a concert that there, and I wasn't here.
Oh.
I couldn't go.
Oh, what a bummer.
Yeah, I thought I was going to be able to, and I thought I was going to go backstage and surprise him. And then I ended up going out of town. And my recollection is I got a job and I had to go, so I couldn't see him.
I'm sure he would understand.
Yeah,
sure would. As busy as he is, I'm sure he would understand too. Yeah, but I'm sorry I didn't get to direct more of those for him.
Well, I'm sure Al would love to hear from you if you ever do get the opportunity, and definitely see you again. Now, if Al happens to be listening, is there anything you'd like to say to him?
Yes. Hi, Al. Al, where have you been? I've really missed you, and I'm so happy your career is going so well. And thank you for a wonderful time doing Ricky.
That's awesome. I hope Al gets to hear that, and I hope you guys get to reconnect and maybe film more episodes of I Love Lucy.
There you go. I think, you know, there were a lot of those episodes. We could do send-ups to a lot of those. <You could.
laughs> Well, Janet, this has just been such a great journey to go all the way back to 1983 and hear all about working on the Ricky music video. Thank you so much for taking your time to speak with us today.
Well, thank you so much, too. This was a lot of fun to talk about all that and think about it. And it was a great time for me, really a great time in my life. So thank you, and good luck with this. This is such a cool thing that you're doing. And I had a really good time. This was a lot of fun for me. So thank you both.
Thank you so much, Janet, for joining us this episode. That was so much fun getting to hear all about the Ricky music video.
We wanted to share a few more thoughts on the music video for Ricky, including a few fun facts we learned after recording with Janet.
When Janet said that she did not remember what the budget was, I knew I had seen it somewhere. I went back and located my June 1983 copy of TV Cable Week magazine, which features an excellent article about the Ricky music video, and there's a lot of great stuff included. And in the article, Al says the budget for the music video was $3,500, but they spent $4,000.
Well, I'm not sure how that compares to other music videos of the era, but that doesn't seem like a ton of money, especially with how great it turned out, even 40 plus years later. It's such a top-notch video.
That definitely was on the low end of music video budgets at that time. And speaking of budgets, friend and past guest of the podcast, Joel Miller, let us know how much he was paid for being in the music video.
Joel played both bongos and congas when they recorded the song for Ricky, but in the music video, you can see him sitting on the floor playing just bongos. To the right of Joel is Hamilton Cloud, playing what Joel said was some sort of singing drum. For their contributions to the Ricky music video, and for their use of their likenesses in perpetuity, they were each paid $1, or 0.025% of the total budget spent.
And Joel's dad, who plays Fred Mertz in the music video, was also paid $1 for eating all their pretzel sticks and then spilling his beer. Plus, Bermuda previously told us that he was paid $1 as well for his performance. So let's see, that accounts for 0.1% of the total budget. Money well spent.
Joel also said something that blows my mind. He said that Weird Al forgot to bring his maracas, so he used an old bowling pin in the scene instead. I immediately went back and watched it, and I can't believe I never noticed it before.
My question is, why did Weird Al have a bowling pin with him?
Well, that sound means we've got a call on the 347 Spatula Hotline. The 347 Spatula Hotline is the official hotline of Dave and Ethan's 2000-inch Weird Al podcast.
Okay, intern Frank, let's hear that glorious voicemail.
Hey there, Dave and Ethan. It's your old pal Chris, the cartoon-loving geek from Canada. And a happy Easter to the both of you. Now, before you ask, yes, I once again put my wacky cartooning skills to the test to make you guys something festively funny for Easter. Come on, you really didn't think I was going to forget you two. Well, anyways, the first two pictures that have your names on them, I guess they don't really need an explanation, to be honest. I got the idea from watching some kids dye some Easter eggs. The end. Ta-da. Now, as for the one with your logo on it, I think that might need some explaining. You see, last year I went down to Amish country during the Easter season and found out that the Amish celebrate the holiday a little differently than us. You see, they have an Amish version of the Easter Bunny who rides around in a buggy with an enchanted rooster that delivers not colored eggs, but colored twine balls. And instead of a basket of tasty goodies, they deliver baskets of socks and quilts to all of the good little Amish boys and girls. And the Amish Easter Bunny also picks out two of the humblest Amish men he can find to help pull his buggy for him. Surprisingly, the two gents who pulled it last year kind of looked like you guys. Their names were Ezekiel Jebediah and Jebediah Ezekiel. Man, I wish I could have taken a picture of the festivities, but since the Amish are technologically impaired, they shunned me for having a camera. So I decided to draw the whole thing instead. And I must say, the Amish were quite fascinated by the way I drew on their handmade paper. But nevertheless, I hope you guys like the pics. And until the next time we chat, have a safe, healthy, and happy Easter. And here's hoping the Easter Bunny brings you guys that immature, radioactive samurai hey boys playset you were asking for this year. See you later. Oh, wait. One more thing. Frank, if you're listening, you can deny it if you dare, but I know the truth. Oh, yeah. I know it was you and your rotten, lousy cousin Francois that sucked the creamy fillings out of my chocolate Easter eggs last year. I got it all on tape, and I showed it to the Easter Bunny. And for that, he told me to tell you both that you can kiss your request for a jumbo-sized box of maple syrup-flavored Kraft dinner with Canadian bacon bits. Goodbye. I hope you two are proud of yourselves, 'cause I'm not. Well, that's it for me. Ciao, guys.
Chris, thank you so much for the excellent call and for the incredible drawings. What great photographic memory you have.
And thank you so much, Chris, for filling us in on the little-known and documented Amish tradition of the enchanted rooster passing out colored twine balls from the back of a buggy.
You know, I heard if you unravel those suckers, they'll roll all the way to Lancaster, Pennsylvania. And Chris, I am so sorry to hear about Frank and Francois messing with your Cadbury cream eggs. Those are just the most delightful treats ever. I can't believe they ruined them for you.
Chris, we love this artwork so much. We'll make sure our intern Frank posts it over on our official Facebook group, group.2000inch.com. And from all of us here at Dave and Ethan's 2000 Inch Weird Al Podcast, a happy Amish Easter to you.
This episode is brought to you in part by Discover Darwin, promoting tourism in Darwin, Minnesota. Not only is historic Darwin, Minnesota beautiful, it's also cheaper.
If you are thinking of filling up your gas tank, Darwin, Minnesota is the place to go.
According to P. Selchert, who stopped by Schmitty's Darwin approximately 3 years ago, price of premium was 21 cents cheaper than the place in Dassel that I had checked first. Awesome!
And if a 21 cent savings isn't enough to entice you, P. also shared that Schmitty's has awesome lighting, clean water for washing the windshield, and paper in the credit card receipt printer.
Whoa! We dare you to find any gas station in Dassel that has all three of those amenities.
And if for some incredible reason you are still not sold on visiting Darwin, Minnesota, the next time your fuel gauge reads E, Annette Yu shares in her well-thought-out 5-star review, always pleasant.
Did you hear that? Always pleasant. Each and every time. Consistently and without exception.
Plus, two other reviewers left 5-star reviews without any comments.
They didn't need to leave comments. 5 stars all the way, baby.
Why would anyone ever fill their vehicle in Dassel? We may never know.
So visit Darwin, Minnesota on your next fueling expedition. Discover Darwin, more than just the twine ball. And after you visit Darwin, Minnesota, be sure to attempt to visit www.discoverdarwin.biz.
Dave and Ethan's 2008 Weird Al podcast is brought to you absolutely free thanks to our incredible sponsors, Burrito Burrito, Wizard Burger, our very own Jackson Scoggins, and Discover Darwin. Our podcast is also supported by everyone else in our Patreon family, with special thanks to our very own close personal friend level Patreon supporters, including Kenneth, Ajax, Javier, Scotto, Matt, Kev, Casey, Allison, Adriana, Gus and Alicia, Zach, Ron, Zeb, Dana B, UH Jeff, Blair, and also thanks to Jason and everyone else in our pretty stinking majestic Patreon family.
If you enjoy our family freaking friendly Weird Al podcast, as heard in the commentary track on the Weird the Al Yankovic Story Steelbook, please consider supporting us at patreon.com/2000inch. There are awesome benefits like getting your name on the podcast, your own private RSS feed, which gives you early access to each and every bonus episode, and the self-satisfaction of doing something important with your otherwise pitiful, meaningless existence.
And once you join, you'll be the very first to hear our bonus episodes the instant that they drop. And do not forget to check out our official merchandise shop over at shop.2000inch.com. All proceeds from purchases go directly towards supporting our podcast.
We love hearing from our listeners and other Weird Al fans, so be sure to join our Facebook community at group.2000inch.com and visit our Discord server for even more riveting Weird Al and Red Rum Tegudi related conversations. You can find both of them linked on our website, as well as information about past episodes and guests over at 2000inch.com or weirdalpodcast.com.
Keep up on new episodes, podcast news, and events by following at 2000inch on Facebook, X, Threads, and Instagram. And be sure to subscribe everywhere you listen to podcasts so you do not miss a single episode. Not only does subscribing help the podcast immensely, it's either kosher or gluten-free, your choice. Plus, we absolutely love it when we receive voicemail via our official patent-pending 27-hour-a-day podcast hotline, 347 Spatula, as seen in the Illustrated Al. That number is 347-772-8852. Give it a call or a text, and you might even hear your message in a future episode.
A big thank you once again to our guest, Janet Greek, for joining us this episode. We'd also like to thank Claire Walsh, Joel Miller, Steve Allen, Steve Allen's son, Bermuda, Johnny O'Hearn, William King, and Chris, the cartoon-loving geek from Canada. Thank you to the Grammy Award-winning Jim Kimo West for our incredible podcast theme song, and thank you to the incredible Weird Al Yankovic, as this podcast probably would not exist without him. And a big thanks to all of you, our loyal listeners, subscribers, Patreon supporters and sponsors, and everyone else who makes our podcast possible.
Thank you for choosing Dave Nathan's 2000inch Weird Al podcast. And until next time, remember to gill and chill, keep listening to Weird Al, and stay cheesy.
Dave, can you believe that 1 year ago, we were in Hawaii taking in all the sun and Weird Al concerts that we could?
Ah, those were the good old days.
I find it just amazing to think that we were in attendance at every single concert that Weird Al and his band have ever performed in the state of Hawaii. We can't say that for any other state, I don't think.
You know what? That is really impressive.
So according to WeirdAl.com, Weird Al performed in my home state of New York exactly 115 times.
Wow, very impressive. And let's see, Weird Al performed in my home state of New Jersey exactly 35 times.
Huh, really seems like that number should be higher.
I know, right?
Oh, don't worry, Dave. I'm sure he would have gone to New Jersey much, much more, if not for the fact that every time he's gone, it sucked!
Hey, watch it! I'll sue ya!
That was Dave and Ethan's 2000inch Weird Al podcast, episode 225-inch.
Every day's a rerun, and the laughter's always king.
Oh, it was so weird. It was really weird.